April is National Bilingual and Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. That's why we're so excited to tell you about a new special series from Science of Reading, the podcast, that will launch later this month. Over several episodes, we'll talk to leading researchers and practitioners about how the science of reading serves multilingual and English learners, and how to best use the science of reading to support those students in the classroom. That's all starting at the end of this month. Stay tuned to this feed for more.
These are challenging times, and we respect your unwavering commitment to your students. At Amplify, we are working especially hard to support you. And as we all grapple with what it means to focus on the science of reading in a new world of remote learning, we're committed to walking with you through the unknown. Welcome to Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. Join us as we talk with experts to explore what it takes to develop joyful, confident, and capable readers. On today's episode, we talk with Dr. Catherine Barnes, President and CEO of Sudden Impact Solutions. She reflects on early responses to COVID-19, how schools responded, and what that meant for students and parents. She shares her story that started with a desire to support students through tutoring and grew into a network that is focusing on parent support. Much of this episode focuses on how best to support parents who are supporting their child's learning because of the remote schooling realities. Our conversation takes us from early COVID response to school closures, the social justice movement, economic realities for parents, and back to school 2020. Well, hello, Dr. Barnes. Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode.
Actually, thank you. I am so excited to be here. Thank you for this opportunity.
We're really excited to talk in depth on this episode. But before we do, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about who you are, how you got into education, sort of some of the work that you're involved now. Just give us an overview of you for our listeners.
Awesome. So I am, again, Dr. Catherine Barnes. I have served in education. I've been in education and have served for almost 30 years now. And interestingly, I started in education as a classroom paraprofessional in a special needs classroom, assisting a wonderful lady who encouraged me to become an educator. At that time, I was getting an undergraduate degree in advertising and marketing and was on my way to Chicago to be a marketing expert of some sort. And through that work, while I was an undergrad, through that work, I developed this love of learning and this love of education. So I went on to add some time to my educational career and decided to get a degree in education. And I started working in education as a substitute teacher, believe it or not.
So bless you.
Yes, I moved into education as a substitute teacher, and after a few weeks was hired by that principal to work in a school in a high school, and I started working in secondary education at that point. I worked as a secondary English teacher, and I loved secondary English. Moved from there into an assistant principal position in a middle school after serving some time as a literacy coach. So I just kind of started moving through my career rather quickly. I went into the literacy coach position and then went on to get a master's degree in educational leadership. And after completing that, within a few months, I was hired as an assistant principal, and from assistant principal to vice principal at a high school, and then went into a principalship at a middle school, and have really worked in secondary education for a very long time. Then I had the opportunity to go into higher ed, so I've worked in higher education, and I've started working with doctoral students as well as master's level students, teaching courses on education, educational leadership, and cultural competence. So in working in those areas, I had an opportunity to work a lot around literacy, around instructional strategies, and around leadership strategies. Moving from there, I went into, again, made another shift and was actually speaking at a conference and was contacted by a person who was serving as interim superintendent at the time, or deputy superintendent at the time, of a smaller school district. And he asked if I would come and have a conversation with them. And I moved into a position as executive director of schools for school supervision, and was charged with a lot of the work around supervising schools, supervising literacy and learning in school settings, and doing professional development and training principals. So from that space, I was then charged with moving into a situation of turnaround leadership and working in turnaround schools, and was able to do some phenomenal work in turnaround, which was really where my heart was, because that's where I spent my time as a principal in all turnaround settings, and had some great successes in those spaces working with some wonderful teams. So moving from that space, I went directly into the work of turnaround and turnaround leader, and we were able to get some amazing results through that work as well. So with that, I moved into a new challenge for me, and I was moved into executive director of early learning. And if you have heard my story, I'd been in secondary the entire time. So then I had the opportunity to move into early learning, and I took that opportunity just because it allowed me to do two things. One, to learn something new, but it also allowed me to create a link that takes me now from being able to really deal with anything that hits us in education, from three-year-olds through post-secondary. So in graduate level work. So I was very thrilled to have that opportunity to do that. And it's now led me into some of the work that I'm doing now around parent and parent engagement. And that's where we are. That's kind of who I am.
Wow. It's a great journey. We're going to talk more about that parent engagement in a minute, but I just want to mention, you can't imagine how many guests we've actually had on this podcast that said something similar about, I was in a different field, and then somebody encouraged me to do something different in terms of my undergraduate educational trajectory. So that's really interesting. So with all that broad spectrum of experience, we're going to make a little bit of a shift, but I promise our listeners we're going to come back together. But we are, you know, right now, the day that we're recording this, we have lots and lots of schools across the country, districts across the country that are thinking about what back to school is going to look like. Some of them have already started. And, you know, this whole remote environment. But before we sort of get to what that looked like, you know, for you in sort of the spring of this year, go back and think about when you first realized that COVID-19 was a real thing. Do you remember when you first heard about it, and remember any of your thoughts about it, any predictions you had about it at all?
Yes. Actually, it's funny that you mentioned that. We were just having a conversation about that. And one of the things that I said is that two things that I will always remember. I know exactly where I was when 9/11 happened. And I know exactly where I was when I realized that COVID was actually changing the way that we were going to do school from this time until whenever this happens to end. So, and I hate to say it that way, but I really just, we have no end. I have no idea what the end is going to look like to this. So in that, what happened is we were actually in a meeting preparing to go to spring break. And our initial thought was that, well, spring break is coming up. And with spring break coming up, we will have this week off to see how things go. And maybe it'll pass in a week. And we won't have to be concerned about it. And by the time spring break's over, we will, you know, have maybe another week or two to come in, a week to come in and get some things organized, and we'll be back up and running. And that turned into something that is now what we see in front of us. So it really became real to me when things started canceling, like schools are not reopening, when we started having conversations about people, unemployment, when we started having conversations about people being out of work and having to figure out how to deliver instruction in different ways. When we started canceling sporting events, I'm like, okay, now something is really, really, really serious about this. So it's when we started having those discussions, it just became very clear to me that this pandemic was really it wasn't something that was hitting and going to go away. This is something that we're going to have to adjust to and figure out ways to deliver instruction and support families in this at this time when no one really understands or knows anything.
Yeah. And on a professional, I'm sure there's like all kind of things you think about on a personal level, but on a professional level, what were your thoughts about teaching and learning specifically at that time?
My biggest concern was, how are we going to continue to deliver instruction in ways that kids can continue to learn, yet provide support to families that need it? Because I understood that everyone was in this tizzy right now, just going around and around trying to figure out, how do we do this? Because no one expected it. So right. My major concern was really about technology, about teachers' use of technology, continuity of programming, and what were we going to do with this now out of school time that we talk about as being a few hours in the evening, and now that being the way, our new way of work. So it really, before, like you mentioned, we talked about the personal things that bubble up, but there was not even time to really give time to think about the personal things, because there were so many professional things that bubbled up that had to be addressed immediately. And some of the things we are talking about just kind of came to the forefront. We had parents who were out of work, and then some who were still working and trying to figure out, now, what do I do with my children?
Yeah.
And after we decide that, who's going to teach them? I don't understand math. I don't understand science. I don't understand reading. I don't understand these things. So what systems are going to be put into place? And school districts were in a space where they were trying to decide, how do we help? Do we have enough technology? Do we give it away? Do we expect it back? How do we do this? So there were so many things that were bubbling up, and it was all happening so fast that it really caused people to, there was no room to pause. And it still has not been room to pause and really plan. It's really been, let's figure out what to do next, because we don't see an end in sight at this point.
That sounds, just me listening to you talk about that sounds so desperate and chaotic and confusing.
And it was, that's exactly right. It was extremely desperate. It was extremely chaotic. And yet we were asking for mercy in that space, because and everyone needed it. School districts needed it. Teachers needed it. Kids needed it. Parents needed it. Families needed it. Everyone needed it, because this is something that none of us have had to actually live through. And we didn't know how to address it. There is no, when you plan for emergency planning and you have those plans outlined, pandemic planning is not something that's on the radar. Generally, it's just not on the radar. You don't think about, I need to plan for a pandemic that's going to cause me to have students learning from home with their parents as their only support when parents can actually be home. And then how do we get into those homes? How do we build those relationships? Hopefully, those relationships are already in place so that parents can get some comfort in knowing that you're still going to do the very best that you can for the children that you serve.
Yeah. So, it is rather interesting in terms of precedent, right? There's no precedent set for this. There's never a time that we've had to do this before or figure out how to quickly transition to, remote learning.
Right. And it was quick, because again, initially you're thinking, give it a week. You know what, by the time we come back from spring break, this will all be over. Well, and that week turns into a month, and then you start trying to develop systems and put things in place. And then we're forgetting the fact that teachers often have children that they have to be concerned about.
True.
So now they're trying to teach their own children, but they're also trying to teach their classes. And that's one of the pieces that we often forget, is that teachers are also parents, and educators are also parents, and they also have their own children that they have to be concerned about. And if parents are supposed to be home teaching their children, but the teacher is the parent, how does that work? Kind of changes the dynamic. It definitely changes the dynamic.
For sure. And so you're sort of watching district after district do this. And I know you sort of have a circle of friends that you started to talk about. What could we do? So tell me a little bit about that.
So So what happened is I connected with people from all over. I'm so thankful and so grateful to have a network of educators and friends across this country. And we started looking at what are other people doing, and it became just kind of this hodgepodge of stuff. No one really had an answer. No one really had a solution. No one really knew exactly what this would look like. So we started brainstorming, and then on a local level, there were cries out, just cry after cry after cry from parents and from students needing help and wanting to know, how does this impact me? Will I pass? Will I not pass? How am I being graded? What happens? I don't have a computer. Mm. I don't have access. I don't have internet. So with those kinds of things, we started looking at what those problems were. And on a local level, we started trying to figure out ways to respond. And quite honestly, we had to come up with a solution, and we had to come up with something rather quickly, because parents needed something immediate, and they needed to feel as though they were still valued in this space. Yeah. And that they could be contributors, but mm-hmm. they didn't know how to do that. And because so many parents are vulnerable when it comes to teaching and learning, and some of them have not had pleasant experiences in the school systems where their children reside, it makes it very interesting. It's a very interesting dynamic, because if there isn't a relationship there, then they don't necessarily have the trust that's needed to feel as though what you're doing is going to push them forward and actually help them, and it won't be done without judgment. So what we end up doing is we end up trying to pull together a group of educators who would start thinking about these things and figuring out ways to help and figuring out ways to engage and to be able to provide meaningful support in ways that were non-judgmental, and that ways that really were able to take kids and families where they are and help to make sure that they felt safe, comfortable, and that as though they had resources available that would allow them to still be able to be successful.
Hmm. So where did you start with that, with the resource support?
So with that, they were, believe it or not, they were just a group of friends. We were talking and we were literally talking about what can we do. So we started off with this grandiose idea of, we're going to put up tents in these underserved neighborhoods, and we're going to set these tents outside and call for everyone in the neighborhood to come to the tent. And you would have these professors that are out there, that some that look like you, some that don't look like you, that are in these impoverished areas or in underserved areas. And we're going to jump in there and help. We're going to do this stuff and tell them stuff and help them with math and all kinds of things. And what was so interesting about that is we were like, wait a minute, we technically can't go do that. So although we're ordering tents and we're thinking about how this is going to go forward and contacting housing authority and trying to figure out how this, we're like, wait a minute, we can't gather people this way. So this isn't going to work. So as we started to think about this, we pulled together a group of educators on all levels. We had elementary, middle school, high school, as well as college professors. And we got into this think tank of starting to really figure out how can we actually do this. Mm-hmm. And with that, we developed this network of people who committed to every day getting on Zoom and inviting parents, along with these community organizers, getting with community organizers and having them to get the word out, and let's start inviting parents to get on these Zooms with us and let us help you help your kids. And this was going to be the best thing ever. Well, of course, we started and no one showed up.
It's just like, oh no.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, we put forth all of this effort. We have all of these minds on the phone just willing to help. But what we had to do was take a step back and realize that we had not built those relationships, and we had not utilized our community partners, our community organizers, our parents in those areas, had not utilized them effectively. Because once again, we're looking at it from an educational standpoint and how we can come in and provide all of this stuff, but we didn't have relationships.
Yeah.
And that was critical. So we had to go back to that area of this whole plan and get our community engagement parents involved and get them to start getting the word out that we were safe. And then we had to start contacting people that we knew, students that we that knew us, students that had worked with us in other capacities, their mothers, their families, getting with churches, getting with others who had a relationship with us, and being able to say to them, we're here to help. We're not judging. We don't really care what your house looks like. We're not looking at that on the Zoom. Do you need a computer? Do you need a hotspot? And when we started building those relationships, and keep in mind, this is all happening like in a span of a couple of weeks. So okay. It's, you know, we're rushing through this. And when we started to build those relationships and got those parents involved, really advocating for our ability and our willingness to genuinely help these families, we started breaking down some of those barriers. And we then developed this, what is now called the Black Parent Support Network. And through that network, we started engaging parents and families in that way, in those ways, and started out with tutoring and bringing them into a tutoring space. And parents were getting on, kids were getting on, they were getting help, they were becoming more comfortable. And what we started to see is that they were communicating with other parents saying, hey, if your son needs help with this, there's some people here that can help you. So we started to grow in that way. And it was really organic growth. And it started happening very quickly. And it's now kind of mushroomed into this thing that we now have, that we've now developed as the Black Parent Support Network.
Great. You know, I'm going to stop you for just a second and sort of walk back a little bit and unpack a little bit of this. So essentially, you just really wanted to reach out to parents and students and provide some tutoring. Let me help your child and help you sort of understand how to help your child at the same time. But I heard you say a lot about parents didn't feel like they trusted you, that they knew who you were, that you were going to actually support and help their kid learn. And so what, can you talk to me a little bit about what some of those barriers that you feel like sort of impacted that trust relationship?
Yes. Well, here's what I have to say about that is this. People are often, we forget about a lot of the parents who are underserved in these communities, in what we have deemed as underserved communities, a lot of those parents were failed by the same systems that their children are not being successful in. Mm-hmm. So there's already a lack of trust. These same systems are the systems that have them in positions where they feel like they cannot help their children. And we forget that part of it when we're talking about how the children don't have support at home or how they don't have these things. We forget that a lot of those parents are the result of these same systems and practices. And because of that, it has allowed there to be generational views of how well this system will prepare you or how well this system will protect you and keep you safe and help you and care about you. And that in itself is a barrier that has to be addressed nationwide. And what we often forget is that as these parents are hearing that you want to help, they don't necessarily know how they can be a part of that process. Mm-hmm. So they see it as judgment. And so when you don't take the time to build those relationships, you have people that are hesitant. They don't know if you're just like the teacher that told them that they wouldn't be successful. And guess what? They're not. Or they don't know if you're just like the person who may have said something to them or didn't offer them an opportunity or who isolated them or did all of these things that parents talk about when you start to have real conversations with them around things that impacted their level of success. So in doing that, it's so important to build those relationships because those barriers are there. Those barriers are very real. And we don't want to talk about them because it causes us to have to again go back and reflect on institutional practices that may or may not have set people up for failure and or success along the way. And it causes us to have to take a look at ourselves. And that's always very difficult to do, particularly when it's causing you to have to reveal some of your own vulnerabilities and some of your own shortcomings as it relates to services that you provided over a long period of time. So that was probably the biggest barrier, is making sure that people understood that we were not coming in to judge you, mm-hmm. and that we're not expecting you to come in and be able to be a teacher, but we do value what you bring to the table. And I think that's where we started to see some momentum, is we started valuing, making sure that they understood we value the fact that you're at home. So if you will allow me to, if you will get your child in front of this screen and make your child sit here for me, I will do this apart. So this is what I need from you, and this is what you need from me. So let's work together. And being able to find a way to make them, to make sure parents understood that you are valuable in this process, and without you, this could not happen. None of this, we could not be successful without you, and allowing them to feel like they're contributing to their child's education. And I think that that's a huge part about engagement, period, across the board, whether it's virtually or otherwise, that we have to make sure that we find ways to let parents know that they're valuable and what they can contribute means something. And it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we pull that out so that parents can see it, because for so long, often they just feel as though school is one thing and I'm something else. And because of that, those two things generally don't blend. And we have to break that down. We have to make sure that we deconstruct that and help them understand that there is value, and they can bring value, and that we appreciate what they do bring to the table. Even if that means your job is simply to make sure he has a pencil and is sitting in front of the screen.
Hmm. So it really sounds like what started as primarily a goal of tutoring, or getting to the student to provide the student some instruction, really shifted and grew into more of a realization that, hey, parents need our support at this moment, and maybe this is the place that we can step in. Am I right about that?
You are absolutely right about that. So what happened with the network is we did start out with tutoring, and then we realized that we needed more. So we started looking at what then can we provide for parents. And we asked the community organizers, who are all amazing parents that do a great job. They just happen to be in underserved areas, but they do a great job and they are engaged and they do want to help. So we started mobilizing those parents and getting feedback from those parents. And our parents were saying, you know, I need help with, I want to get a GED, or I need job skills, or I need you to, can you tell me how to fill out an application, or can you look at my resume and tell me where I'm going wrong? And we started becoming this thing where we were now supporting parents in these very interesting ways, even around mental health and mental health first aid and mental health support, connecting them to resources and talking to them about stress and managing stress, and then moving into parenting and some things around that. But and then just kind of helping them to build their skills, and again, making connections to necessary resources so that they could continue. They became a part of this network and they became a part of this learning. And on top of that, we started then figuring out, okay, what else can we do? What else do we need? What else do they need? Well, parents want activities that they can do with their kids. So we started developing these education kits. And these education kits, we're now, if you could see my office right now, have bins of like 300 education kits over here that we've put together for this next distribution. But our education kits go out and they're very simple kits that parents can use, but they're so meaningful. We have, in the kits that are right here with me now, we have seeds for a science project with the directions for parents and for kids. We have math manipulatives and rulers and things with an assignment, two assignments, and then directions for parents, directions for kids. We have all kinds of things. Then play activities. We have a doll making kit in this kit that we're putting out now, where it's literally an arts and craft activity. So we try to make sure that we're hitting reading, we're hitting math, we're hitting science, we're hitting arts, something that has to do with arts, and some play. But we give things so parents have things that they can actually do with their kids, as well as things that kids can work on independently in case they're in those homes where parents have to work. but parents can give them an assignment, and it even tells them how do you lead this as an assignment for your child? What do you say to your child, and what do you want to see when you get home? So it gives them all of these directions, and these kits, we just started making them up, and we have given out, gosh, probably 600 kits so far. And again, it just kind of came out of, what can we do next? And that seems to be the question that we continue to ask. What do we do next? How can we support our families? How can we support our community? How can we make sure that our most vulnerable families are still getting something that is allowing them to be able to move forward and to progress in this space of academia, but as well as in the social space?
That's amazing. And I know part of this network includes a Facebook group. Am I right on that?
You are, yes. So this Facebook group is called the Black Parent Support Network. Anyone can join the group. By all means, join the group if you need support. And what we do with that group, in that group, is we make sure people are informed. Anything that's going on with schools or anything that they need in terms of updates, we are posting those things in that group. We're also making sure that we're doing inspirational things. We're putting job postings in that group. We've actually gotten to the place now where we're able to hire two parent liaisons, which is phenomenal.
That's amazing.
I know. I'm so excited. We're so excited. We're so excited. But we're hiring two people. So we put those things into the group. We put podcasts into the group. We put information videos into the group. Step-by-step instructions as to how to do certain things or where you can find things. We list resources in the group. And parents are engaging, and they're finding their voice. They're being able to share and ask for things. And we're serving as advocates for them, because parents are able to post in there, you know, I'm having trouble getting in contact with my teacher, and she's telling me that I have to do this, and I don't know what this means. And we are literally getting on the phone and calling those teachers and saying, hey, what does this mean? What are you asking of this parent? And how can we assist in making sure that this gets done? So we're going to board meetings and speaking up for these parents and doing those things. So we've actually become now these, as we're continuing to morph into this huge thing, we're now advocating on behalf of these parents and going into different places and speaking up for them and helping them to look at what's in their IEPs and helping them to evaluate, are these services being met and do you need something else? What is it that we can help you find? So it's really morphed into things that we never imagined when we started saying, let's put our tent outside and tutor kids. That was the craziest thing. I have no idea why we did that, but we did. That was our first, we just wanted to do something.
You know, you got to start brainstorming someplace.
Exactly.
Well, what's interesting about all of this is, you know, as everyone knows, that in the midst of, you know, remote learning and quarantine issues and COVID-19, we had a big breakthrough in terms of the social justice movement as well. So where were you and your parents with all of that?
Wow, that is such a good question, and I'm so glad that you asked that, because they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
What happened in that space is that we had to take that on, and parents wanted to know, what does this mean, and how do I mobilize? How can I be active? What do I need to say to my children, and how do I help them navigate the space? And we started really having to think about what do we tell people to do? What are we doing? What are we going to do as a base? What are we going to do as an organization, which is now turned into an organization? What are we going to do as a network to be able to support parents in this, but also to make sure our kids are safe and make sure that we are communicating things to children to help them understand this rage and this frustration and this anger that they feel? How are we helping them to understand it? And how are we helping them to navigate it? And that became a part of our charge. And what we had to do realistically is just start having conversations and look at some of our allies from across the lines and say, we became a space where people were asking, what do we do? Not necessarily what can we do, but what do we do? Like, what is our next step? And how do we organize in ways that will get outcomes? And that's the difference. We wanted to make sure people felt as though they had a voice and had a space to voice their anger and frustration without judgment. But we also wanted to help them understand what next steps look like if you actually are going to make a move in this, along this continuum of learning and this continuum of emotions around this social justice movement. And our goal was to empower through education. Mm. Our goal was to empower through activism. And our goal was to empower through vocalizing and verbalizing what you're thinking and feeling in ways that lead you to be able to be impactful in your, within your sphere of influence. And that's what we focused on. We knew that we could not take on the entire movement, but we knew that we could have a movement in our organization, and we could start a movement and support people who were trying to mobilize by giving them the tools that they needed to be able to break down barriers and to be able to have these, to walk through doors that have traditionally been closed to people who are in, that are primarily most impacted by these kinds of actions, these actions that are taking place.
Hmm. And I'm trying to figure out like the right next question to ask, but I think you'll get the spirit of this. But you know, you talked earlier about parents, of you building trust with parents, right? In the initial part of this, we want to reach out to help you with education. How was that transition in the midst of sort of the social justice issue? Where did you feel like you had trust built that you could, you know, come in and help support or hear some of the issues from parents?
Yes, I think we had started building enough of a foundation that people felt comfortable saying some things and mm-hmm. asking some questions. But I will tell you that there was still this wall that was there, because our network is one that is made up of people who come from all walks of life, and they're helping to be supportive, but they also, parents also have this thing that says, wait a minute, okay, now something else has happened, and mm. I need now to redefine your position in my life. What wow. does that now look like? I have to redefine who you are through now this new lens. And the thought is, every time this barrier is chipped away, something happens to remind us that we're not there yet. So then the wall goes back up, and you have to go back to chipping it down just one stone at a time. And that is so taxing, but it's so necessary, because what happens is we have people then that decide, okay, I'm going to withdraw completely, or I'm going to go to one to the other extreme and get so engaged and involved that I can become either massively impactful, or I can become massively destructive. And being able to help people bring those two things together really became a part of our major work in that space. And that was really around letting people know that we're still the people that you trusted, and we're still here to help and build, helping and empowering them, giving them a voice and giving them an opportunity to say things. You have no idea how impactful it is for parents, and I'm assuming perhaps you do have an idea, but having parents to come in and say, okay, this happened to me, and I need you to tell the school board this. Can you tell them this for me? And having people from our team say, absolutely, we will. Let us help you craft this letter. And then when you go to say it, if you don't feel comfortable, then I will go with you. And I'll say it, and you'll be there in the moment. So you'll get an opportunity to be a part of this. And I think that is where we are now empowering people to find their voice.
Yeah.
And we're empowering people to use their voice to make a difference, and to make a difference within their sphere of influence, and allowing that to spread like wildfire. And I think that people are now beginning to find value that they may or may not have seen even in themselves or in any system that they've been a part of before. And it's simply because they're being allowed to come in as they are and feel as though they are welcomed, valued, and then supported. without judgment.
You know, it's just, my mind is a little bit blown thinking that all of this has come from your goal of wanting to tutor kids. And, you know, we are on a Science of Reading podcast, but it's a great reminder for both myself and our listeners that the context in which the student is surrounded is so important to the moment-by-moment learning environment in front of a teacher.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's actually the point, is that there are so many things that impact learning. And until we realize and recognize the fact that it's more than just a teacher standing in front of a child and delivering information or sharing information, that there are more dynamics that have to be addressed, until we start putting real systems in place to address that and breaking down these silos of dysfunction, and making sure that we're addressing the students that are in front of us today where they are socially as well as academically, we're going to continue to see these phenomenal gaps in learning, these phenomenal achievement gaps. We're going to continue to see these phenomenal disconnects in levels of success. And we have to do something about that and stop pretending it does not exist. And I think that's where we run into such a huge problem, is we've gotten comfortable in things being status quo. We've gotten comfortable with things just running the way that they run, and not saying that although this isn't functioning, that we need to do something different. It's although it's not functioning, we'll continue to do the same thing. And until we change that mentality and we start looking at this as a holistic, developing a holistic system of engagement, we're going to continue to lose this battle.
That's pretty powerful. So now we're thinking about back to school 2020. And so as it relates to the work that you're doing right now with your, you know, supporting your parents and things, what are some of the things that you're doing to help support them, and what does that mean for both students and parents?
The network itself, we have worked on our plan for opening of school. And that is to continue to go back into a space of providing online tutorials, online support for students, for particularly for families that are opting to keep their kids at home. We also are continuing to work on the parent learning segment that we have and the parent learning processes that we've put into place, so that we can continue to empower those parents. What my biggest concern is right now is that we have parents that are very vulnerable because they have to go back to work, or they need to go back to work, but they don't trust the systems that are in place for school. And they're having to make a decision between, do I go back to work and keep food on my table, or risk at the expense of possibly risking my child's life? Or do I stay home and keep my child out of a school where there could be 5 kids or it could be 500 kids? Do I keep my child out of that space to keep them safe and risk losing everything that my child needs to be able to be successful, or to keep our home, our lights, our food, keep those things going?
How do you give that advice to people in an environment of both remote learning and some of the social justice movement and the economy the way that it is? How do you provide advice?
Well, as far as the social justice movement, my advice is always that we have to keep moving, that this train cannot stop.
Yeah.
And we have to continue to empower people to move and to continue this movement while we have momentum. And for so often, these movements start and they stop. They start and they stop. But what I like about this is that there are more people engaged and on the ground. So people are literally on the ground and not letting it go. And I made a comment to someone the other day that said, okay, they made a post about, okay, all right, enough already, we get it. And I'm like, you don't get to tell me that. You don't get to tell us when it's enough. You don't get to tell our parents when it's enough and when you get it, because no one has gotten it for years. So
that's
now
the
all
problem.
Of a sudden, so we're not going to have a conversation about it being enough, because now it's making you extremely uncomfortable. When you have people who have been uncomfortable for hundreds of years. So your 40 and 50 days of discomfort, I'm sorry, it just doesn't measure up. So with that being the case, we have to continue to move parents and mobilize parents in that space and let them know that they can be active, but also continue to educate students and show them how they can be engaged and involved, and continue to work on training them to be able to be the people who step out in this movement and make a difference in ways that are impactful and impact long-range change. So doing that, but then also with trying to figure out how do people make that decision, it's hard. It's hard to navigate that and help parents make those decisions. And I'm just glad that there's a network of us trying to work through it and not just me, because I don't know that I have the answer. I don't know. I don't know that I have the answer, and I don't claim to. I think that people have to really make those decisions based on what's in their heart and what they know is going to be best. And unfortunately, some people don't have that option. Some people don't. It can't be a choice. Their children have to go back to school. And because of that, they worry every day. And so then we get back into the mental health space. And are they being supported in that space? How do you make those decisions? And then what happens if your child gets sick? Where are the supports on that end? It's just too many unknowns at this point, and it just makes me very uncomfortable. And I can, and with a 28-year-old daughter who has nothing to do with this, so I know that it makes others uncomfortable as well, who do have to make these decisions about where their children go and are they going to be safe in those environments.
Yeah, we were talking before we started the recording. You mentioned something about, you know, how difficult it is to sort of be a leader in education right now, because people look to you for answers and we don't have any.
Yeah. People are so accustomed to going to educators for everything. I get asked questions about things that happen in different states. Like, did you hear about this thing that happened to that school? I'm like, well, no, not like officially the education brain of the world, but but we do get those questions, as you know, we and people look to us to have answers, and it's hard, but we have to be very honest and say, I'm not sure, or I don't know, or I don't know how to help you make that decision. What I can talk to you about is about protocols that we have in place. I can talk to you about systems that we have in place to help you be safe. I can talk to you about things that we have in place to help your students learn. What I cannot tell you is how to make a parenting decision around whether your child should be engaged in a digital environment or whether they should be engaged through brick and mortar. I don't know how to help people do that.
Yeah. I think, and one other comment you said too about making sure that people understand that we're not being judgmental with them, that we're not going to judge them for the decisions that they have to make that are very personal.
Right. And it is very personal. And I think if we can remove that whole, I think that one barrier itself is one, if we can remove that barrier of judgment and the perception of judgment, because judgment is very real. We do it.
Yeah.
But there's also this perception of judgment that makes it a whole lot worse than it actually is when you, from a parent's perspective, because they often, and this is coming from parents, they have shared that I feel as though if you are on my Zoom, that you're going to be looking in my house. And if my child is, you know, I don't want you looking in my house, or I don't want you, you know, it's just all of these things. And it's come from years of just not having valuable relationships with people, with the people that we serve. And that's just the truth. And mm-hmm. Not being mindful of our own prejudices, our own biases, our own judgment, and the way that we deliver that, the way that it comes across in the things that we do in the systems that we perpetuate. So because of that, we have to make sure that we are conscious in that space. And our lack of consciousness is what continues to make this a concern. I think that it's hugely important to allow people to be engaged in the way that they can, not in the way that we think they should. And once we do that, we can return value to parents and let families realize that they do play a role. And then we can start to talk about some of the other things that we'd like to see from them. But we ask We often ask people to do things without having a relationship with them or without making them feel safe to do it. And because of that, then we start judging, and it really just perpetuates our whole thought that, see, you don't care, you're not engaged, you're not involved. And we're forgetting the fact that we've not made it comfortable to do so.
Wow. That's really, there's some wise words of advice in there. There's probably lots of things we can pull apart. But we probably should bring this full circle. And what I'd love for you to leave our listeners with is, and this is a little out of the blue, so I'm sorry if I'm catching you off guard. But I'm just wondering, with your years of experience in education, where we are now, if you think 10 years out from now or 5 years out from now, what do you hope we have learned from this particular moment in time as it relates to education?
I hope that we have learned that everybody needs to be at the table when you're planning, when you're scheduling, when you're thinking about things that impact. If it impacts them, they need to be at the table. I would hope that we have learned that there is value in our differences, and that there is also value in our collective voice. I would also hope that we have equipped our families with the skills that they need to be advocates for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we would have learned that we have to teach the behaviors that we expect, because they're not necessarily being given at home. So, and we need to get rid of this ambiguous language of respect and just all these words that come up that we use to define how people are acting, but it's defined in so many different ways. So I honestly would just, if I had to look at the perfect vision for us within this time frame, my vision would be that we are in a place where people are socially accepted, that they're conscious and cognizant of their biases, of their behaviors that are resulting from their biases, and that they're not lying and saying they don't have them, but they're actually saying, I have this, and now let me change my behavior to address it. Because it's not the bias that I'm trying to deal with. I'm trying to deal with the behaviors that result because of that bias. Because some of those things are so deep-seated that it'll take time to uproot those and to pull those up so that you can actually unseat those things. But what we do have is we do have a responsibility to have responsible behaviors, regardless of what we think or regardless of how we've been raised or what we've heard our great-great-grandpa say about people of color or people of minorities, and not just our great-great-grandpa, some other people that are saying some very derogatory things right now around women and around race and around all of these things. So I think it's important that we look at using this time to create a foundation that will allow us to move forward in a way where there is respect and responsibility and validation and voice for those who have been underserved. But then there's also a dismantling of these structures, these institutional structures and practices that perpetuate these systems of thinking and learning.
Well, I just very much enjoyed this conversation today, and thank you for leaving us with such a great vision, and we hope we can get on 5 years from now and see that all come to life. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and we'll be sure to link our listeners in the show notes to some of the resources I know we chatted about before. We'll be sure to link listeners to those resources. So thank you again for joining.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the time.
We're so grateful to our amazing guest today and to all of you making a difference in the lives of students every single day. Be sure to check the show notes for resource links from today's podcast, and we want to hear your stories and successes. Follow us on Facebook at Science of Reading the Community, or if you're looking to help implement the science of reading, send an email to sormatters@amplify.com. Tell us what guests you think we should book, or tell us about the research that really excites you. And be sure to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Susan Lambert.